All right, guys, so welcome back. So what we're going to do before each little session here is we're going to do, either Tarek or I are going to read something, then we're going to do a two-minute meditation, and then we're going to start off with the prayer that's up on the screen behind us. So both Tarek and I work out of different meditation books, and this is a daily meditation book called 365 Tao. Mine's been taped back together a couple times. I think I got this when I was about, I don't know, somewhere between 3 and 6 months sober, and I carry it with me. And this was today's, and I thought it was kind of appropriate. It's called Perfection. The hero comes down from the mountain, radiant with the power. Yet one tussle with a dusty old man quickly tumbles him into the dirt. In olden times, young men and women who wanted to be extraordinary trained in the mountains with a famous master, away from the distractions of society, isolated in the cleanliness. They remained on a high peak and did not come down until they had attained great ability. Such people were heroes, the pinnacle of cultivation. However, in their subsequent wanderings in the world, such heroes would often come upon some oldster who could quickly best them. Whether in a philosophical debate or physical skill, there was always some obscure wanderer who could outshine even the greatest of heroes. Why? Because the hero only had perfection, the strength of youth and courage. The oldster had the advantage of experience and wisdom. There will always be people in the world better than yourself. Learn to recognize those elders who are wiser than you and respect them. Know that you yourself will not be great until you have lived a long time. To perfect oneself is difficult but not rare. To have perfect wisdom is rare indeed. And I will meditate for 2 minutes. Prayer.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about this weekend, the big book, alcoholism, addiction, the 12 steps, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth. Amen.
So, we'll say this prayer at the beginning of each session because I don't know about you guys, but when I was new, I thought I knew some stuff. I thought I knew kind of what needed to be done and where I needed to go. And even today, at over 6 years sober, I still think I know some stuff. And if I think I know some stuff, I can't have a new experience. I can't be open-minded to the possibility that there's something different than what I currently have. That reading I did before the meditation, I read that this morning, and I thought that it was kind of appropriate because some of you guys maybe are progressing on the path. You've come down from the spiritual mountain of knowledge of how to be sober and do all these things, and so, you know, Tarek and I, these oldsters up here, you know, telling you what we've done, you're probably going to be resistant to some of it. But along those lines, Tarek and I don't know what your spirit needs to wake up. We don't know what your spirit has been through. We don't know what experiences are necessary for it to become awakened. And for that reason, when we say we would like you guys to ask questions, we mean it. Come up in between sessions, say, hey, when you said this, what did that mean? Or are you going to talk about this? Or can we explore that? Or have you figured out a technique for this? Because we've got kind of a format that we're going to follow, but at some point, we're going to need to connect with each one of you at a different level. Now, it's really fun for us to sit up here over the course of this weekend because we will sit there and watch, and it's almost like little flares get sent up from people. It's fascinating. There will be a guy in this room that Tarek and I'll notice, that will be completely asleep the entire time, paying no attention to us. And somewhere around late day two, day three, this flare will go, and the guy will all of a sudden get engaged, and he'll be like, whoa, did you? And it literally, it almost is like an energy burst that we feel, okay? There are a bunch of you now that are all engaged that you may lose interest over the course of the weekend, and that's okay too. The first one of these we did, there was a guy that sat over here, and he is like one of my favorite people I've ever encountered in my life. This guy was clearly not wanting to be at the recovery place that we were doing this workshop. And, you know, meditation's really hard for a lot of people when they first come into recovery because their mind's so busy. But this guy found a way to meditate on a spot on the wall for an entire weekend. And, like, he was just fixed to that spot. Now, his energy was incredibly negative and terrible, and he was so mad that he had to be there. But it was fascinating because the amount of energy that this guy took to not pay attention was, like, amazing. I mean, this guy, it was one of the most phenomenal meditations I've ever seen in my entire life. And he has no idea. This guy had this incredible power, but he was just using it the wrong way. But the first one of these we did, there it was down at the Bridges of Hope in Louisville, Georgia, which the rest of the country would pronounce that Louisville, but here in Georgia we pronounce it Louisville. And what's fascinating is Tarek and I had no idea what we were going to experience when we walked into this place. Bill Brown, our speaker tomorrow night, who you guys absolutely are going to love because Bill just emits this energy. I mean, this guy is just, he is so excited about life, and it comes out of him. Literally, just like, you may not like the guy, but you're going to have to at least smile at his energy because that's what he's got. And we went down there, and he gave us this introduction that, like, talking about being humbled when you didn't know that you needed to be humbled. Because he gave us this introduction, and these guys, the way that they they clapped and everything. It was just like, wow. Like, I mean, they were forced to be there, so, and they were forced to clap, but it was still powerful, right? But so over the course of this weekend, different guys would come online and they'd start asking us questions. And then, you know, we hope that we connect with some people. We hope that we are entertaining. We hope that this isn't this terrible experience for you that you're going to be incredibly bored by. We take feedback and we try to improve whatever we're doing to make it more entertaining, to make it more exciting, so that it's not just a weekend of people talking about the steps. But out of this, I guess, what, 12 months later, these guys started showing up at the meetings that Tarek and I go to. And it was the same guys that were asking the questions. And there's 10, 12 of these guys that they're still sober now. And it's like, and they're out there doing the deal. And I mean, I think our hope would have been that we could have reached one or two of the guys. But I mean, it wasn't just us. I'm not saying it was just us. It was Bill Brown and the way that he gets these guys excited about recovery. And that, just like when I went to that retreat when I was 90 days sober, we must have said the right combination of words to get these guys engaged in a way that they were really excited about this stuff. And we hope that that's going to happen with you guys. We know it's not for all of you. You know, if we reach one or two of you, if we disturb you about alcoholism and drug addiction a little bit, such that maybe you take this information and it ruins your drinking and using going forward to the point where you're maybe willing next time you come back, if there is a next time. There's another method. That you might actually try to engage this process. That would be success for us. Is that if at some point in time in your life you get excited about recovery, what you see up here is not an act. We're actually this excited about this stuff. We don't do it perfectly, but we try. We're both works in progress. If you guys could see me with my two stepsons, you would see one of the most flawed individuals on the planet. When you see me interacting with most of the rest of the world, you would see a person that's actually pretty good at this thing that we call life. Now, that's a surprise because that never was me before. I was the guy that just kind of felt like everybody else got an instruction book and I didn't get one. And so I would hang around and wait for you guys to show me who I was supposed to be before I presented to me, and really hope that you guys would never get together and compare stories and figure out if I was the same for all of you, because I wasn't. I was mostly full of it in every way, shape, and form, because I really had no idea how to live. I really didn't. I looked good on the outside. I had some stuff. I had accumulated some of the things that in this country we strive for. And I could tell you that I make less money now than I did at my peak. I live in a much less nice house than I did at my peak. I drive a car that's not nearly as nice. And I've never been happier. How does that happen? How does that happen? Now, there's a bunch of myths that are out there in the rooms of the different fellowships that people like to perpetuate. There are a lot of jingles and sayings and slogans that people perpetuate that if you ask the people that use them, how do you do that or what does that mean, they're going to repeat the same slogan back to you that they just told you, because they don't know. Anybody in here ever see the movie Bull Durham? All right, so in Bull Durham, there's this guy, Crash Davis, who's like the the distinguished statesman of the minor league baseball, and then there's this guy Nuke LaLoosh, who is like this young rocket arm pitcher, right? And Nuke is about as unintelligent as a guy could be, because everything's always come easy to him. So he's never had to work really hard at anything. And so he gives like this interview, and it's terrible because he just rambles on about a bunch of nonsense. So Crash like pulls him aside and gives him a bunch of like little things to say in an interview so that he can like sound intelligent. You know, it's like, well, I'm just here to help the ball club out. You know, good Lord willing, the creek doesn't rise, we might win a couple games, all these things. And when Crash gave them to him, he intended for them to be used like in one, use one in an interview. And like the very first interview when Nuke gets up to the big show is like he uses them all together, like in a stream of consciousness, like so that he didn't say anything, but he said them all. And I was in a meeting this last Tuesday, and literally a guy shared for 5 minutes and said nothing but the slogans and jingles of AA strung together. Like, it was like, you know, it's just, you know, I just got to do the next right thing and live this thing one day at a time, and put one foot in front of the other and make sure that I don't get too up and don't get too down. And he just strung up, and I'm sitting there listening to him going, this is phenomenal, but he is actually saying zero. He literally said nothing. And so if you hear somebody say some of those things, ask them, well, what does that mean? If we say something that doesn't make sense or that you think that we're full of it, come and ask us about it. So who in here thinks that meeting makers make it? All right, we might have some training going on here. Who in here believes that alcoholism, and please be honest, we're not trying to embarrass anybody. It's just we're going to smash some of these over the course of the weekend. Who thinks that addiction and alcoholism are the same thing? Okay, good. Who believes that living amends exist? Who thinks that once they work the steps, they get to choose whether or not they drink or use again? Who believes that making coffee is the service that they're talking about in the 12th step? Who has their God figured out? Who in here thinks that alcohol and drugs are their problem? Should have more on that one, because I don't think that many of you are fully trained yet. Who thinks that they can actually remove their defects? Who believes that the relapse starts when you start drinking or using again? Who in here thinks that they're recovering and that you can't be recovered? Who thinks that this is a two-part problem and not a three-part problem? Mind and body only.
In other words, mental obsession and physical craving. That is our problem. Who believes that?
Okay. Who thinks that we don't drink or use one day at a time? Who thinks that they work steps 1 through 9 one time and they stay sober the rest of their life? Who believes in triggers? Who thinks that they've got a pretty good relapse prevention program? Who thinks that the meetings are the program? When do the promises show up in your life? Have you figured that out? When the promises show up, the promises that they talk about in the meetings? The This one is one I wrote down because of conversation I had with a guy earlier today. Who thinks they need a job before they can focus on recovery? That was phenomenal. Who thinks that they can keep coming back? There were a couple of people that were actually really honest there, and thank you for being honest. There were a couple of you that have no idea what I was even asking you. There were some of you that weren't paying any attention and don't care. But thank you for the people that were actually honestly answering those questions. Because one of the things that I have found today that is the most powerful thing that I can do, and it stinks because I have kids, right? And if anybody in here, a dad or a mom, so one of the things that really stinks is that like when you achieve the title of dad or mom, that like you automatically become an authority according to these people that have no idea how to live life, right? And so along with that, they like to ask questions. And I don't know about you guys, but I was a guy that if somebody asked me a question and I didn't know the answer, you still got an answer. and it probably sounded somewhat plausible and good because I might confuse you enough that you didn't really know what I said, that maybe, or I just had enough of the information that when I explained it to you, I made it make sense. I love listening to the people that today are like I used to be, because I may know something about the subject that they're talking about and they're within earshot, and somebody asks them a question and they start saying something and I'm listening going, oh my God, he's so wrong. But I don't call him out on it because he can have his own experience with it. But one of the most phenomenal experiences that I have today is my kids will ask me a question and I say, you know, I don't know. Let's look it up. And they got this cool thing called Google that we can Google it and actually... and then sometimes, like, my son will read it to me. I'll be like, okay, I was pretty close on that one, but I would have given you some wrong information. And so today, on if I get a 10-step call, which we'll explain what that is, when I get a 10-step call from a guy and they ask a question about something that I don't know, I'll say, I don't know the answer to that, but Tarek has some experience with that. Or call Mills. Call Steve, or call Glenn, or James, or Nathan, because they've been through the experience that I know that they can help the person. And instead of trying to transmit an experience that somebody else had to the guy that's asking me the question, I will put them in touch with the person that actually has the information firsthand. I was not capable of that before. So,
Thanks, B. I'm Tarek. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict.
Tarek.
And so as the weekend unfolds, we're going to address all of these. We're going to give you our perspectives on these. That was our version of Mythbusters. Those were all myths, in our opinion. And what we're going to do is we're going to bust them up all weekend long. And so if you are still confused, we encourage you to say, ask us. One of the most important questions you can learn as you travel the spiritual path of recovery is ask people, what do you mean by that? Or just how do you do that? And don't take everything at face value. Ask the questions. So, everybody got their big book?
Yep.
All right, let's turn to the title page for me. I'm gonna give you guys your guiding light, so to speak, or your compass for the rest of your recovery if you decide to live this way of life. Everyone sitting in this room most likely has seen the circle and the triangle symbol before, correct?
Yes.
What do you guys think of when you see the circle and triangle? AA? The legacies? The three legacies, recovery, unity, and service. So, AA took this symbol and used it, and up until 1995, they got into a legal problem with it, and the attorney general in the state of New York said, look, if we're going to go, and this is going to go to court, we need you to release the last name of all your members that are on this document. And instead of AA saying we're going to break the anonymity of our members, they decided not to mess with it anymore, and they took it off all their memorabilia and all their literature. So it was taken out in 1994, 1995. But something you guys have to realize is that the circle and triangle symbol was around long before Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an ancient spiritual symbol that means body, mind, and spirit can exist as one. And you can be entirely whole in all three areas. And so the three legacies that were given to us in the 1955 convention in St. Louis were recovery, unity, and service. And each one of those is analogous to one of those three pieces, mind, body, and spirit. So what do we do here? You guys, if you get a sponsor and you go into the 12-step process, you have now taken your mind through the recovery process. And what does that address? It addresses our insanity. On page 37, I believe, in your big book, you don't have to go there. I think it's page 37. It says, it gives you the best definition of insanity that I've ever heard. And I am not a fan of the definition of insanity that we hear all the time. Doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. Yeah, sure, it makes sense. You know what my favorite definition of insanity is? The lack of proportion and the ability to think straight. That's our problem. Think about it. You take away the drugs and alcohol, we begin to lack proportion around sex. We begin to lack proportion around checks. We begin to lack proportion around food. We begin to lack proportion around physical fitness. We begin to lack proportion around shopping. I mean, you name it. The lack of proportion shows up. And we can't think straight in those areas. If you take your mind into the recovery process, it addresses that. Once my mind went through the recovery process, yeah, I began to struggle, but I had much more proportion and I could think straight way much more often than I could before. Okay? The 12 steps can do that. The inventory process, the fifth step process, the amends process, it is all geared to changing your thinking. It forces you to change your thinking. You don't even have a choice. If you go through that process, your thinking will change in many areas. I got a guy who says often that I used to be close with that used to say, you know, he was 43 years sober at the time, and he was appalled by the amount of things he had to change his mind about over those 43 years of being clean and sober. I've been clean and sober almost 10 years, and I've had to change my mind about a lot of stuff. But that's beautiful. To me, that's being really free. You know, I'm not stuck in this box that says because I've been given a value system and a belief system such as this that I can't ever investigate anything outside of that. I think you're in bondage if you subscribe to every single value system and belief system that's been given to you in your life. You need to investigate these belief systems and ask yourself, where did I get this idea from? Is it really true in my experience, or did some well-meaning parent or teacher or minister or whatever it is just tell you this is it and give it to you as gospel without you investigating it? So what I'm asking you to do is live a really, truly free life, which translates into doubting and questioning everything and finding your own truth. And it's going to be different for everybody. And so taking the mind into the recovery process is how we do that. Now, you brought your body tonight to this meeting to experience unity. The first level of healing that I experienced was the first time I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous, and I heard someone tell part of my story, and I said to myself, holy cow, someone else has actually been through that experience too. I'm not the only one that's been through that. And something inside of me began to heal. The sense of isolation began to dissipate. All right, so let's take unity a little bit further. Home groups are vitally important. If you don't have a home group and you don't go to group conscience on a regular basis, you're missing a very important piece of the recovery process, of the program. So get a home group. Go to group conscience. Get a job at your group. So the first home group I had, I gave myself a job. It was a very large meeting. It met on Friday night in an auditorium, and I had to set up 150 chairs. And a lot of the home group members didn't really want to set the meeting up, and I just took over that job. I had that job for the first 2 years of my recovery. You know, by the end of it, I had my sponsees helping me set up the meeting. I would meet with them before. It was a very meditative and therapeutic process setting up these meetings. And it was my job. It gave me a sense of belonging and a responsibility to that group. And then as my recovery has evolved, it goes even deeper. Do you have 4 to 5 closed-mouth friends in your life that know all the darkness that you're traveling with? Anybody here watch Dexter? All right, Dexter always talked about the dark passenger. Everybody sitting in this room tonight has a dark passenger. The question is, who are you discussing it with? It's there. Don't try to discount it. Every one of us, every human has it. There is a dark side there, and we want to hide it from everybody. We want to go to 12-step meetings. We want to put on our Sunday best. We want to put on our makeup, put on our cologne and our perfume, and walk through this door and walk in with a smile, and somebody asks you, how are you doing? You say, I'm doing great, and on the inside, you're dying because nobody knows about the darkness. So I encourage you to find those 4, 5, 6 people that you're completely transparent with, that you can have honest, authentic dialogue with, not this superficial crap. Somebody around you's got to know what the darkness is. And then you will experience true unity in your life. You will experience a sense of belonging that will keep you here. It will tie you to these rooms and to these meetings and to this fellowship. And God willing, you're going to find a pocket of enthusiasm where you're at, and it's going to feel like home. Most people don't stick around because it never feels like home. So how do we make it feel like home? Get a home group. Go to Group Conscience. Develop some accountability. We call them accountability partners. And start talking about the darkness. I know it's fun to talk about all the good stuff too. But it's all the dark stuff that's going to send us back out that door. And so how do we feed our spirit? So I've discussed recovery of the mind. We take our body into the unity of the fellowship. And how do we feed our spirit? By taking others through the 12 steps. The sense of isolation and not belonging is addressed if you have significant unity in your life. The lack of proportion and the inability to think straight is addressed if you work the 12 steps. But there's this other thing that addicts and alcoholics struggle with. I don't know about you guys. I used to get bored really easily. I used to feel like I was never going to be satisfied, that my life had no meaning and no sense of purpose. And I needed an effect produced because being just sober was miserable. Being just clean is miserable. There has to be an effect produced in my life. So what's going to produce that effect? For me, I found it very intoxicating to sponsor people and watch them go through this process and watch them change. I grow more by watching you change than I do by working the steps myself. If no one's informed you, you working the 12 steps is not even the work. The real work in Cocaine Anonymous and Heroin Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous is when you sit down and sacrifice your personal time to take someone else through the 12 steps. That's the real work. Bill Wilson says in his story, if addicts and alcoholics fail to perfect and enlarge their spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, you will not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. So that's what protects us. That's what keeps us safe and protected, is working with others. And it feeds our spirit at the same time. And if you can perform action in all three of those areas, you will experience mental, physical, and spiritual wholeness in your life. So if you're ever struggling in recovery, this is the most effective exercise to do. Sit down, take out a piece of paper, and find out, what am I doing in my personal recovery, my personal journey with the first 11 steps? What's going on? What's going on with my home group? What's going on with Group Conscious? What's going on with accountability? Or am I isolating? Am I not talking about certain things? Have I compartmentalized my life? You know, we fall victim to this delusion that our life has compartments, and if I'm dishonest in this area, it's not going to bleed into this area. That's a delusion. It's all connected. It may take some time, but I promise the dishonesty in one area will creep into every area of your life. And what am I doing in sponsorship? I love it when I ask guys, are you sponsoring anybody? I've got like three sponsees. Well, when was the last time you met with them? Well, I haven't met with any of them in 3 weeks. And this guy really hadn't called me in a month. But they're only sponsees in name. So when I sponsor guys and the guys that know me, the sponsees don't set the pace. I give them deadlines. If they don't meet their deadlines, beat it. Go get another sponsor. I got enough friends. But a lot of my sponsees become my dearest friends. This guy next to me, I've sponsored him for a while, but he sponsors me now, right? He is like my sponsor now, and he's my best friend, but it started as it was a very mechanical sponsor-sponsee relationship, but at some point in the game, it just changed. We were no longer sponsor and sponsee. We are just two spiritual warriors trying to grow spiritually and seek God. That's it, right? I tell that story because I think it's important because we have this belief system that the sponsor is always the teacher, which makes the sponsor think every time you call your sponsor, if you ask a question, he's got to have an answer for you. You actually think he's going to answer every single question, right? You have to have other people in your life that have had those experiences. We all fall victim to this idea that I got to answer every question. But fortunately for us, we have had men in our lives that have influenced us to a degree where we know we don't have all the answers, and then we don't try to even answer the question. I say, I don't have that experience. Let me find you someone who does. So that is the compass. Okay?
So on the service part, what he was talking about in sponsorship, like making coffee, setting up the chairs, all that stuff, that is service. But it's service to the unity part of the circle and triangle. So, you know, when you get that text message or that phone call, you know, we're all good. Who needs some service work? We're going to go help Sally Mae move. That's not the service to the spirit that they're talking about in the circle and the triangle. The other thing is it's a three-legged stool, right? Is that if I take one of those legs off of a three-legged stool, I might be able to sit on it for a little while, but it's going to become difficult at some point. If I take two of the three legs off that three-legged stool, it's not going to take much to knock me over. So if I'm attending just meetings and thinking that that's going to treat my alcoholism and drug addiction, a good strong breeze might blow me out the door. But if you're grounded in all three areas of the circle and the triangle, recovery, unity, and service, it's going to take something pretty big to actually knock you off that stool.
There are a lot of people who are going to disagree with us on terms of what service is. And it's neither one is wrong. It's not about right and wrong. It's a perspective. And it keeps me grounded in knowing that I have to sacrifice my time to help other people work the 12 steps. And it feeds my spirit.
Addicts and alcoholics by nature are selfish, self-centered people. Everybody in this room is selfish and self-centered just because you are. And this service element, this taking somebody through the steps, gets you out of yourself and makes you help somebody else. Not to mention the fact that it points out the holes in your game all the time. When you find yourself talking to a guy saying, hey, have you ever considered this? And as you're talking to him, that other voice in your head's going, why don't you consider what you're telling?
All right. You know, the best definition of spirituality that I've ever heard is enlightened self-interest. The best way for me to get mine is to make sure everybody else gets theirs first. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if it's false. But I'll tell you what, even if it's a lie that makes me a better person. Okay?
Enlightened
self-interest. The best way for me to get mine is to make sure everybody gets theirs first. So, with that being said, we're going to talk about this thing called recovering versus recovered. One of my heroes is a guy named Big Frank McKibben. He passed away about 10 years ago, but he used to say something that I really, really enjoyed hearing. He used to say that people who say that they are recovering probably aren't. What he meant by that is it's a false humility, a false modesty. In 10 years, I have not had an obsession to smoke crack or drink whiskey. Therefore, I've not put any in my body and set off the abnormal physical reaction. I'm as recovered as I'm ever going to get. Am I cured? No. But it's like tearing a muscle in my knee. I tore my meniscus. I've had to have knee surgery twice. I've recovered from both injuries. But if I don't take care of my knee, can I rip those muscles again? Absolutely. Same thing with our recovery. We can reach a recovered state. You know, there's another man that used to say, I hope you only have to go through the recovery process one time. You know, we talk about the recovery process a lot, but the initial recovery process happened for me almost 10 years ago. I haven't been in that initial recovery process again. I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Now, if you go to page XIII, forward to the first edition, I want to point something out. This is where the book describes what it is we recover from. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Heroin Anonymous, and more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics and addicts precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of this book. This book, when they started writing it, there was 40 of them. When they ended writing it in April 1939 and it was published, there's about, 100 of them. If it was good enough for them, it's good enough for me. I'm a purist. I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an archivist. I've read up on it. I think it's magical. I think it's divinely inspired, no doubt about it. But notice that they say, we've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and they don't say spirit. If people that said they're always going to be recovering would only say, I'm always going to be recovering from the broken internal condition we call the spiritual malady. On some level, I'm never going to become a saint or become enlightened. Maybe. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe. But most likely in this life, I may not reach that point. On some level, I'm always going to be having problems with my internal condition, which when I'm identified with it, it gets my mental mind moving so fast that I'm not consciously aware of the presence of God in my life. All I'm identified with is the movement in my mind. And that is, I'm never going to completely recover from that. That's why they left it out, in my opinion. But the mental and physical aspects of addiction and alcoholism, I'm recovered from that. I am not cured, but I am recovered. And trust me, I believe it's much more attractive for a newcomer to hear that we can recover. Right? I don't want a newcomer to hear I'm always going to be sick. That's not a very attractive thing for the new people. Okay?
There's some parts of this book that we will actually, Tarek and I will get down into the minutia of the words that they use, because in some ways, the words that they use are very important. Now, studying the words is not going to get you and keep you sober, okay? But it helps you understand what it was that they were talking about when they wrote this book. And so, recovered, we've got the Monday night meeting that we go to, we have a 1935 dictionary, and looked up recovered, see if it meant something different back in 1935. And the definition is return to normal state of health, mind, or strength. I think most people looking at me today would say that I've been somewhat returned to a normal state of health, mind, or strength. Definitely have reached that place as it relates to alcohol. Okay. Now there's another word in what Tarek read that I think kind of, if you don't believe this word, then you don't have to listen to anything else that Tarek and I say the rest of the weekend. The word is precisely, okay? To show other alcoholics precisely, and I looked that up too, and it says in exact terms without vagueness, okay? To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So we're going to spend the entire weekend talking about our experience and this book, okay? This was, if you understand the history of alcoholism and drug addiction prior to the writing of this book, if you were an alcoholic or an addict, there were three hospitals in the world that they would send you to, or you went to the loony bin. Because they assumed that if you continued to park your car in somebody's living room over and over and over again, you must be insane. Okay, so they sent you to the loony bin. But so this was the combined experience of everybody sober in the world in 1937 to 1939. They wrote it down in a book, and they wanted to transmit an experience that would tell somebody in another city precisely, exact, in exact terms without vagueness, how they reached the state of being recovered. So I believe that if they wanted to use some other word other than precisely, they would have used some other word other than precisely. But they chose that word on purpose, as they chose all the words in this book on purpose. If there was some other way to convey what they wanted to convey, they could have conveyed it. But instead, they chose this. So if you look at us and you say, why are they so into the book? Why are they spending so much time dissecting this and looking at it from a different angle? It's because this, in 1939, was the collective experience of anybody that had any substantial sobriety in the world for all time. And guess what? We still use the book. They have not found another way since 1939 to transmit this specific experience. So yes, we may seem like we like this book. Yes, we may dissect the words. Yes, we may dissect the sentences. It's not because we like to just kind of get into the minutiae of stuff, although we kind of do. But it's because we're trying to help you understand this as we understand it from our current place in recovery.
Thanks, B. Last sentence in that paragraph, we're besides our way, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Anybody in this room think the 12 steps are your way to not using drugs and not drinking? Okay, well, I just gave you the answer. It's really your way of living. When I first got here, it was really about just not drinking and just not smoking crack, but I quickly discovered that I had been ill-equipped to live life. I was, one of my greatest fears was being a productive member of society. Why do you think I lived in this subculture, traveling around the country, seeing all these bands? Because I never had to exist in society. I ran from it. It was an extraordinary fear. I had no blueprint for living life. I knew nothing about what it meant to be a man. I learned all of that from the 12 steps. Not some counselor, not some therapist, not some IOP program, not some sober living, and not a treatment center. I learned it from the 12 steps and my relationship with God. That's what we have to offer here this weekend to you guys. We're going to keep pointing you to God over and over, but for addicts and alcoholics, it can't be just about belief in it, and it can't be just about faith. We need to go deeper, and that's why the 12th step is there, because we need to take people through the steps, and we need to witness. We need to touch, taste, feel the power of God. And how do we do that? When you sit down and sacrifice your time and watch someone else change, it will become the bright spot of your lives. That's another thing we focus, you know, what we want to do over the course of the weekend is we want to excite you about sponsorship. We want to excite you about sponsorship. So this is not our way to quit drinking, not our way to quit using. This is our way of living. And trust me, the whole universe, it benefits by God, us staying clean and sober, okay? The universe is a better place if we're clean and sober. It has its advantages for all, right? And the tenets and the values in the 12 steps, I wish we had some, maybe we do have some Al-Anons or some Koh-Anons or Nar-Anons in here, but the 12 steps are, anybody can benefit with the application of these principles in your life. Anybody. And I want to talk about anonymity real quick. When they got sober back in the old school days in Akron, Ohio, everyone knew everybody's last name. And there's like this misconception out in the real world that we are literally invisible, right? What would happen if one of your closest friends in the program, Mike C., gets in a car wreck and you don't know his last name and you stroll down to the ER and you go into the ER and say, hey, what room is Mike C. in? And they're like, well, what's his last name? I don't know. He's one of my best friends, but I don't know his last name. His name's Mike C. Well, you can't go see Mike C.
And I actually had that specific experience. A friend of mine, Tony, had a hip surgery. We went down to Emory to go visit him where he was in his place where he was recovering from his hip surgery. and another guy from my home group and I, we walked down there, we walked in, went to the front desk, and I asked for Tony, and I used his last name, and she's like, oh yeah, he's in room 237. We get on the elevator, and the guy that's with me goes, I just realized I didn't know his last name. Can you imagine if we walked in there, went to the front desk, and said, we're here to see a friend of ours who's had surgery. Oh yeah, what's his name? His name is Tony. Okay, well, what's Tony's last name? M? And who are you? We're close friends of his. Okay, and you don't know his last name? Like, does it sound right? Does that seem to... So if I didn't know Tony's last name, we would have, A, looked like idiots, probably had security called on us, and we would have not seen Tony, right? So we're not anonymous to each other.
It's important that we know this because the anonymity, if you read this book called Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, it's a history book about how early recovery was in Akron. And Dr. Bob used to say everyone gave their last names out. And when you came, they had one AA, one Oxford group meeting a week. It wasn't even AA meetings in the early days. And, you know, they didn't stay sober off meetings. They had one meeting on Wednesday night. It was a three-hour ordeal. And if you showed up to Dr. Bob's house to go to the meeting and you didn't bring your family, he'd tell you not to come back again unless you bring your family, because the recovery process was for the entire family, because they all suffer from alcoholism and addiction. Even if they're not ingesting the drugs and alcohol, trust me, they are suffering from alcoholism and addiction. All right, most of the time, their addictions are us. That we relapse, they relapse right along with us. And so what they're talking about in that book when it comes to anonymity is the fact that, you know, when you walk through that door, it doesn't matter if you're a custodian or a doctor. All of that falls away. You're a drunk or an addict. That's why you will have at times someone that's a custodian, sponsor, or physician, because of the spiritual anonymity. Alcohol and drugs are going to kill. They don't discriminate, and that's a spiritual principle to adhere to. The other anonymity that we have to deal with is, you know, if I run into Brandon. Okay, I'll give you a perfect example today. I was doing a presentation for work at a therapy practice, and the guy that hooked me up with the appointment was in the program, and the one of the therapists asked me, "How do you know him?" And I said, "Oh, we have mutual friends." And I could tell she wanted me to go further, but because of anonymity, I could not go further. That's all I could say is, we have mutual friends. I couldn't break his anonymity. Now, I broke my personal anonymity. I don't care if people know I'm in recovery. So that's anonymity. So if I, Stephen, I'm drawing a blank. Tell me your last name again.
Waller.
Stephen Waller, did I just break your anonymity? No. We're not anonymous amongst ourselves, right? We have to protect our anonymity. We can't break someone else's anonymity out in the real world. We need to know each other, okay? So they talk about that on this page, and so I wanted to touch on it. You got anything you want to take from
me? Yeah, so if drugs and alcohol are your problem, when you're done with treatment, you're done. Okay? Because treatment will dry you out, clean you up, and you're done. You're out the door. If alcoholism and addiction are your problem, when you walk out the door of treatment, welcome. Life starts. If all a person needed was to go through treatment to live and be sober, then treatment centers would turn out clean and sober people. Who in here has been to more than one treatment center? Did it work? Something more must be necessary. So for those people that raised your hand, drugs and alcohol are not your problem. Living life without drugs and alcohol are your problem. And this is one of the misconceptions that the world seems to perpetuate. My lovely wife is not a She's not an alcoholic or an addict, but she was watching a show one day and she called me and she said, why do they always talk about treatment in movies when they say that somebody's got a problem, but they never talk about working the steps? Because that's what we perpetuate.
Oh, one of our friends puts it very eloquently. He says if drugs and alcohol are your problem, then this heart detox and 30-day treatment that's as hard as it's ever going to be for you. If alcoholism and addiction are your problem, you ain't seen shit yet. So it's just starting. It's a much deeper problem. We're going to take a 15-minute break. Thanks, guys.